Robert Harris is a prisoner. If Texas has its way by the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations underway to execute Harris by giving him a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than one-third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston vigil reporter Jennifer Simmons, and special guest, law professor Kenneth Williams, author of the book Most Deserving of Death, examining whether the death penalty really punishes the worst of the worst. The Execution Watch begins.
And good evening. This is Ray Hill. We are not pleased to be doing another Execution Watch this evening. We received word about four or shortly thereafter this afternoon that the United States Supreme Court had denied giving a stay to Robert Williams, 40. He's from Lubbock, but this is a Dallas case. And sometimes we deal with cases that are less pleasant than others. This is a difficult case to talk about. It's a difficult case to hear. And, of course, it's always difficult to have to deal with the reality that the state of Texas, in your name, is going to execute somebody today. We have Gloria Rubeck awaiting. Gloria, you're on the air. What's going on?
Hi, Ray. The media has just walked in, and people are honking to our signs. Thank you. Here come the witnesses. Robert Harris's brother and two pen pals, one from Florida and one from San Antonio, are getting ready. They're crossing the street right now. There's a large group of people out here. 3, 6, 9, 10, 11, 12. Goodness. I see the witnesses, yeah. To the family and friends of Robert Harris, we are with you tonight as the state of Texas prepares to murder your loved one. We extend our heartfelt sympathy, our thoughts, and prayers to you tonight. There's a woman out here who's drove from San Antonio with her friend who's been writing to Robert Harris. They call him Bobby. To Bobby, for 8 years now, and she is now kneeling down praying and surrounded by six other friends of hers. There's Carl Rodenberg, who's here from Germany. There's people here from there's our friend from the Mexican restaurant down the street who has become friends with prisoners' families as they've eaten in his restaurant before an execution. There's a woman from Houston who is getting her divinity degree, who's going to be working with churches in Houston against the death penalty. There's people from Dallas, Huntsville, Houston, San Antonio, Germany. I'm not sure where these other folks are from. There's a large group here.
There are some folks from France in town that are going to be here for an execution of sorts. It is to be held next week. We hope not.
Hopefully not.
But at any rate, if they should show up, give them hospitality because they'll be in the studio.
Okay. I see week. Two women that I haven't been over to talk to yet. So perhaps those are Sarge's friends.
Okay, well, listen, Gloria, the process has started. We're going to talk to a vigilant here in Houston, and we will be, but call us as soon as something else happens, okay?
Okay, all right. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is Gloria Rubeck, and Gloria Rubeck is with the abolition movement, the movement to abolish the death penalty. And you can learn more about what Gloria is doing by going to their website, abolitionmovement.org. Abolitionmovement.org is the website. That is Gloria Ruback. She is frequently covering the things at the Death House in Huntsville. And now we switch over to Jennifer. Jennifer, are you there?
Here, Ray. How are you?
I am well. Where are you?
Well, we're 16 in front of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church here in Houston at the corner of Woodhead in Alabama. We have about 10 or 12 familiar faces here that are standing in coincidentally beautiful, beautiful weather. You couldn't get a nicer day in Houston than today.
That is very true, and it didn't come a minute too soon for me, that cooler weather, and that helps turnout and everything. Besides giving our expression of our appreciation and support for the vigilance there.
Right. I would just like to have a shout-out. Our leader, Burnham Carroll, who has just been released from the hospital, he hasn't missed one of his vigils in years and years. He's not here today. But we want him to get well quickly and get back out here with us, unfortunately, all too soon. So that's Burnham Carroll that we say hello to from the sidewalk here.
I get to meet that youngster at occasional meetings.
Yes,
and
his wife, Joan, is carrying on. She is still here. She brought the sign. She makes the sign with the name of the person who is to be executed tonight. So she does a great deal of work, and she is here herself tonight.
And through her, send our regards to him.
Yes. I would just want to say I think that scheduling 11 executions over the next few months is just totally unconscionable for the state of Texas. And I just want to know what kind of society and state we want to live in here.
I appreciate that, Jennifer, and you can find out more about the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, of which Jennifer is an active member of and is holding forth as kind of leading demonstration activist tonight, and you can find them at TCADP, the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. That's TCADP. DP.org. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Ray.
Bye-bye. And that is what is going on. Also, we have Susan Ashley in the film. Susan, what happened in this case?
Okay, what happens in this case? This is in Dallas County, and there is a man named Robert Harris. He's working at a car wash. He had been working at a car wash for about 10 months before the killings. Okay, on a Wednesday on March 15th in 2000, he apparently exposed himself to a customer. The customer told the manager, and the end result of that is Mr. Harris got fired from his job and he got arrested for the offense. Okay, that was on a Wednesday. Well, on a Sunday, Mr. Harris went to a friend's house, met up with a friend. He spent a day with the friend. And what the friend did is he sold cars. And it ended up where Mr. Harris borrowed a car from his friend Junior, had a demo car or a loaner car from the car business. And so Mr. Harris borrowed a car from him. When he had the borrowed car, now Mr. Harris also owned his own car, but he borrowed a car. He went in the borrowed car and he went to another friend's house. This friend was Billy Brooks. He went to Billy Brooks' house, and what ended up happening is Billy Brooks called his stepson and arranged for Mr. Harris to borrow a gun from Billy Brooks' stepson. Well, because Mr. Harris had worked for the car wash, he basically knew that they picked up the money, you know, daily in an armored car, except for Sunday. And so he basically knew by Monday morning there would be a couple hundred, presumably, for the armored car to pick up.
Just a couple of hundred dollars is what this case is about?
Apparently so. It is a car
wash. How many people got killed?
It's...
Well, actually, I think it's made $200 or $300 in the cash register to make change, but there was other money.
Oh, there was other money.
There was the receipts were there, and then the $200 or $300.
Oh, okay, well, okay. So this was say bigger than a $200 or $300 thing.
Probably so.
Okay.
The only thing is the armored car picks up every day except for Sunday.
Yeah, except for Sunday. Yeah. So whatever a car wash makes in 2 days.
So
right. Yeah, they had the weekend receipts there for the sure. for the armored car.
Okay, so anyway, Mr. Harris went to the car wash at about 7:15 in the morning. He came in, he forced the manager, the assistant manager, and the cashier into the office. He forced the cashier to open the safe, and he forced all three people to get down on the floor, and he shot them in the back of the head.
Mercy.
And the manager, Mr. Lee, he apparently slit his throat as well. While Mr. Harris was still at the car wash before he had left, three more employees showed up, arriving, assuming they were going to go to work as normal. He forced those three employees to kneel down on the floor of the lobby, and he shot all three of them in the back of the head. Another employee came in, and that person, Mr. Shields, saw the bodies, and he saw Mr. Harris near the cash register. Well, Mr. Harris told Mr. Shields that he had discovered the scene, and there was apparently a short conversation with Mr. Shields. Mr. Shields, shall we say, left the scene, and went to a donut shop to call the police. Apparently, Mr. Harris followed Mr. Shields to the donut shop, and while Mr. Shields was on the 911 call to the police, Mr. Harris apparently got on the phone, and he claimed that he found the bodies there on the scene. And basically, after that, Mr. Harris left. He returned the borrowed car to his friend, Junior. Then he took a cab to his friend's house that had arranged for him to get the gun. And when he got to Mr. Brooks' house, that was the friend who arranged for him to get the gun. He apparently had the money from the robbery and other articles that were used in the robbery. He sorted it out there, returned the gun, and then I guess took a cab to a hotel room and expressed the intention that he planned on killing an ex-girlfriend was what he planned on doing next.
And he was apprehended there.
Well, one person survived. Now, there was one person who was very badly and permanently injured who survived the shooting. But, of course, the other person, Mr. Shields, obviously the police did not believe that he had discovered the bodies.
Well, that gives me occasion to bring in a law professor at this point. Kenneth Williams, professor.
Hello. Yeah, hello, Ray. How are you?
You're on the air. The title of your book is Most Deserving of Death, An Unusual Opportunity. But you put a question mark at the end of it. Explain the title.
Sure. The Supreme Court has said since 1976 that its endeavor was to identify those who were most deserving of death. And the reason why I put a question mark there is I'm questioning whether or not the Supreme Court has actually done that. In my view, the Supreme Court has not. We don't execute those most deserving of death. It's kind of a random process.
Well, we deal with a lot of cases here on this Execution Watch show, and this is among the most serious cases that we deal with. I think Jim pointed out that there was one other of a similar nature that that we dealt with some time ago. But usually, we discuss in this room and say, well, you know, if this case had happened now or in a different county, it wouldn't even be a capital case. There's a random nature of who gets tried in death penalty cases and who does not. Was that your finding?
Very much so, yes. Not only had he committed this crime in a different county, he would probably not be executed. If he had committed this crime in a different state,
killing five people in the back of the head, he wouldn't be executed in the other county. Well, what county wouldn't do it?
And many other counties that would not do it because, for one thing, many counties can't afford to do it.
Yeah.
They can't afford to.
Only one that I know, Waller County, said that.
Yeah, but the cost of all of that, Professor. You analyze this pretty into your. Thank you very much for your interesting book.
Sure.
I noticed that you did some research from 1998 to 2008, where you're talking about the percentage of ineffective assistant of counsel cases that was handled by the 4th, 5th, 9th, and 11th Circuit. And you give the statistics there of what percentage. The 4th Circuit didn't give anybody any relief on ineffective assistant of counsel, whereas the 9th Circuit gave less than half before a Wiggins case and more than half after Wiggins case. What is the significance of those figures and that issue?
Well, it shows you that many people who end up on death row end up there because they've had bad representation, but only a very small number in most jurisdictions are able to actually get that situation rectified. And I think it shows you the random nature of capital punishment, that if you live in California or in the Ninth Circuit, your case is much more likely to get reversed because your lawyer was bad than if you live in Texas or if you live in Florida or if you live in Virginia.
Well, there's a case in the news today where some states equivalent to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has said that basically the consumption of a quart of vodka a day was not any indication that the attorney representing the guy in court was ineffective.
Yes, I'm familiar with that case. I shared that case yesterday with my class. I teach a class here in South Texas on capital punishment. We discussed that case. He consumed vodka on a daily basis. He actually testified after the fact that he should not have been representing the guy. He actually admitted that. And still, the 11th Circuit ruled by 2-1 decision that his attorney was not ineffective.
That was an amazing opinion. Elizabeth has a question for you, our producer.
Yes, Professor Williams, one of the things that interested me was in your book you talked about why it is so difficult to prove ineffective assistance of counsel, even when you've had ineffective assistance of counsel. Could you talk about that, please?
Sure. One of the things you have to do, you have to do a couple of things when you've had ineffective assistance of counsel. The first thing, you've got to establish that your lawyer was, in fact, ineffective, which means that they didn't represent you reasonably, the way most attorneys would do so. The second thing that's especially difficult to do is you've got to show prejudice, which means that you've got to show that there's a good likelihood that the case would have come out differently had your attorney perform better. And that's usually very difficult to establish because oftentimes there's evidence against the person. so it's hard for them to establish that, well, I would have been acquitted or I would have gotten a life sentence had my attorney performed better. So that's why those claims are very hard to prove. The guy in Florida that Ray referenced, he actually lost on a prejudice issue. What the court said was that, well, yeah, the attorney did not act professionally. He was not effective. But the defendant couldn't establish that the case would have come out differently. And, you know, that's very hard to do. Justice Marshall talked about that. A lawyer makes a difference in a case. We saw that in the O.J. Simpson case. A good lawyer makes a big difference. And so it's very hard to say that a good attorney would not make a difference, no matter how overwhelming the evidence might be.
Well, is the outcome standard the same thing in all circuits, or does that vary from circuit to circuit?
No, it's the same test from circuit to circuit, but they apply it differently. And what I talk about in the book, for instance, the Ninth Circuit has a majority of Democratic appointees to it, whereas the Fourth, the Fifth, and the Eleventh, you have a majority of Republican appointees. So you have these judges who are applying the same law, but they're applying it differently. They're interpreting the law differently.
Well, do you think it's all that partisan, or do you think it comes from a political philosophy? I mean, a judicial philosophy? you know, because I am flashed upon the Chief Justice that virtually handled the Brown versus Board of Education case was a Republican appointee and had been a prosecutor.
Right, sure. So you certainly have some very honorable Republicans serving on the bench, Republican appointees, but I think what tends to happen is that they just see Democrats and Republicans tend to see life differently. I mean, we can certainly see that in our present presidential election. And so that means that when they get on the bench, they also see these legal issues differently. You know, the standard is so malleable. Did the attorney perform well, and would the case have come out differently, that you and I can look at the same case and we could see that differently depending on our life perspective.
Well, and the authority of the district attorney is awesome in making these decisions, because, of course, Harris County has a reputation of being one of the most death penalty-oriented jurisdictions in the world. I mean, other than Texas, Harris County sends more people to death row than any state in the union.
That's right, more than many countries.
Also. Right, and that the statistics on that has changed under the Republican administration of Pat Likas. What do you see the evolution there? Is or can you discern any justification for the evolution?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. I think, for one thing, it costs a lot of money. These cases cost a lot of money. You're talking about two attorneys throughout the process. The person gets years of appeals, you know, 10, 12, 20, 30 years sometimes of appeals. Experts, you're talking about a very expensive proposition, a capital case. So even in Harris County, I mean, we've had some tight budgetary situation here in Harris County, so they can't continue to seek the death penalty the way they used to. And I do think the fact that she is different, and she did bring some reforms to the office, and she was not willing to apply the death penalty in any case where it plausibly could be applied. The DAs here in Harris County in the past, if it plausibly could be applied, the death, they could ask for it. They would usually seek it. She has a much more deliberative process in deciding whether or not to seek a death. But I also think the fact that it costs so much also motivates her reluctance to some degree also to seek the death penalty.
And you say that there at TSU Law School.
I'm at South Texas.
South Texas. At South Texas Law School, you teach a course on execution law.
Right, that's correct, on the death penalty. That's
what,
correct.
What, give us a thesis of what that is all about.
Sure. We look at the substantive law regarding capital punishment. The Supreme Court is, and I talk about this in the book, I mean, they've created a whole body of law that applies just to capital cases. And we go through that law. The law that the Supreme Court, and we go through the history of the death penalty in the United States, and we talk about some of the theoretical and philosophical moral issues regarding capital punishment. We talk about the law the Supreme Court has created, largely since 1976, that apply only to capital cases. And then we talk about some of the procedures of executing people. And then I bring in some guest speakers. For instance, yesterday I had the public defender for Harris County speak to the class. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have somebody from the DA's office in a couple of weeks and come in and talk about what it's like to prosecute a capital case or what it's like to actually defend somebody on death row. And, you know, to give the students an idea if they want to do this sort of work, what it entails.
Well, I noticed that the new co-host of the Prison Show, which is on tomorrow night on KPFT, is Anthony Graves, who is an exoneree, and Anthony is spending a lot of time going around talking about prosecutorial misappropriation or misuse of prosecutorial powers in his case. Mm-hmm. He, of course, was exonerated, and after 18 and a half years incarcerated, refused to cop a plea to get out quicker.
Right.
He stuck there until it was over with, and the state has been kind of generous with him. Folks that want more information about South Texas College of Law, and I want to apologize for getting that wrong a few minutes ago, can go to the college's website, which is stcl.edu, STCL, that's South Texas College of Law, .edu. And Professor Williams, thank you very much for being on Execution Watch tonight, and thank you very much for your interesting book. I will continue to study it before I give it back to Elizabeth with fervor.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
And if something exciting happens over there, keep us please informed.
Sure will.
All
take
right.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're expecting a call momentarily from Huntsville about the progress of the process. I'll tell you where we are with this case. Right on time, right at the top of the hour, Gloria called and reported that the media had crossed the road. What that means is the media crossed the road from the old administration building into the walls unit itself where the execution chamber sits. That means to us that the process is continuing. Following the media's crossing, the witnesses for the person being executed crosses the road. There are other witnesses there for the various victims of the case, but they do not follow the same path as the execution chamber. So you have some folks on either side of the issue. Susan Ashley told us this was not a pretty case. There's a lot of blood in this case. How much ink is there in this case? Who wants to pick that up?
Larry, why don't you talk about the punishment issues that came in on punishment?
Sure. This is a case where 28-year-old Robert Wayne Harris was charged with having committed five murders in one criminal episode of an aggravated robbery, also injured a person. And he was charged with five murders, of which the state pursued the death penalty on two of them. And so having been found guilty, in terms of submitting the issue of punishment on a death penalty case where on a capital murder case where the state is seeking the death penalty, the issue is life or death. And so the issues are submitted to the jury, three special issues. That is, whether it's a deliberate act, what he's just been convicted of, intentionally knowing to killing people, future dangerousness, and then mitigating evidence. The evidence presented at punishment included several things, including the fact that they were pursuing two of the murders, so the evidence of the other three murders would come in, and also the fact that he had committed another murder while he was working in the same car. While 6 months after he got out of prison from this prior conviction, he committed another murder, and he actually even took the police to the place where the unsolved murder had occurred. He, as I mentioned, had gotten out of prison the year before for burglary, having served 8 years in prison for three burglaries. And he'd also been charged with unauthorized use of motor vehicle. Several prison personnel, 15 of them, appeared and talked about his conduct while in prison. While he was in prison, he was actually required to attend a program for aggressive mentally ill offenders. Actually, while he was in prison, much of the time he spent in prison, he spent in administrative segregation. That's the prison inside the prison, saying you're too dangerous to be with the other inmates, so we're going to isolate you in administrative segregation. He was known to be particularly combative in prison, and he continued to get into lots of incidents with other inmates, threatening to kill prison personnel. He assaulted assaulted prison personnel, assaulted other inmates, dealt drugs, refused to follow orders, and engaged in sexual misconduct in prison. So these were the kinds of things that were introduced at the punishment phase of the trial. And actually, at punishment,
do we know what his sentence for burglary was?
8 years.
8 years, and he did 8 years. 8 years, and he did 8 years.
He served pretty much eight years.
Yeah.
He might have gotten out of maybe a month or so earlier. Okay, but he's I think he's on parole for maybe a month or so. But he did almost a flat eight, and really had been out for I believe less than a year before. While he's out, he again commits another murder that was unsolved at the time. but he, and even on this murder, he confessed, he gave a written confession and confessed to the news media, confessed to other people, in terms of these particular murders, the murders for which he was sentenced to death. There wasn't really mitigating evidence in the case, not particularly mitigating. And in fact, his lawyer, on closing, I'm not sure how much he could have presented, but the closing was I understand fairly short, less than a minute, saying, you know, some trials about guilt and innocence, but, you know, some trials about punishment. And in essence, the lawyer fall back, hold the state to its burden of proof. And the state's burden of proof is that, the action were deliberate. He was found guilty of intentionally and knowingly murdering, and that he was
that
a future danger.
That
and
may have, in this circumstance, not been ineffective assistance of counsel.
And I haven't read all of the history of the case, but from what I've read, I have not seen anything that,
let me comment
raised
on
the
that.
Level.
Yeah. I knew you had pondered.
Here's what. Here's the deal about that. And I've been in that situation before. In a case like this, everybody knows that he's going to be found guilty because he made three confessions, found it, then and people identified him being at the scene. He made a 911 call.
Did the live at five.
Did the live at five. There's no way he's going to be convicted. So when you do, you've got to separate what the lawyer did. At guilt or innocence, you remember your issue is going to be punishment. You do not want to insult the jury's intelligence at guilt or innocence by arguing your client is innocent, because you're going to look like a fool. And so what you're going to do, when he made that one-minute closing, that was on guilt or innocence, not punishment, but on guilt or innocence. And the reason they do that, they want to have some credibility in the eyes of the jury when they argue punishment, because he can't turn around and insult the jury and say, there's argue for not guilty, when everybody knows he's going to be convicted. He's going to save that. I'll give you an example. I defended a guy years ago who killed his wife, stuffed her in a barrel, and out in Pasadena. And the police said it was the easiest crime they ever saw in their life, because everybody called up and told about it. And so I told the jury to begin with, if I was on the jury, I'd convict him, because I knew the issue would be punishment. And so you want to save your credibility as a lawyer for the punishment phase, and that's why the lawyer did this. And the one-minute argument was made at guilt or innocence.
Sure.
And they took the jury only, some say 11, some say 15 minutes. But there was some mitigation evidence presented. But how do you mitigate this? I mean, that's a real tough question. Because he did have a pretty tragic childhood. His father shot and killed his mother in front of him. He had a pretty bad childhood. But that doesn't, you know, you can have all the talking you want to, but the problem's going to be, and you've got five dead people and added to six.
I know we've discussed this before, but if you're the lawyer and you want to get up there and you want to tell the jury, well, look, this guy witnessed the murder of his own mother and all of that, that might not change the jury's view of some of this.
So I'm saying you can get, I don't know how in the world, and that's why I kind of disagree with the professor, this case, I don't care if you tried this in the most liberal county in Texas, assume there is such a thing. When you have this background and your only issue is whether or not you'd be a danger in the future, there's not a jury anywhere in the world would look at this man's background, because a lot of times you'll find in death penalty cases, these guys adjust well in a structured environment. They do well in prison. And that's one of the arguments we always make in death penalty cases, give him life without parole because he gets along in prison.
Yeah.
This guy didn't get along in prison. He didn't get along outside. Everywhere he went, he was a troublemaker.
Anger? Mental illness?
We were talking about this earlier. Where do you draw the line between mental illness and meanness? I don't know where you draw that line. In a case like this.
Is it constitutional to kill somebody that's mentally ill?
It is. It's constitutional to people mentally ill, yes. You can't kill them if they're retarded, but if they're mentally ill, yes.
Okay. And so this, we've been hidden here for a while with this guy.
Right.
I mean, this is just, they're victims along the trail, an unsolved murder and then the massacre. But this is where he was going.
Right.
And there's not much any lawyer could have done. I need to report to the audience that it is now 6:34, which means that by this time in a normal execution, before they changed the chemical formula, the witnesses would have left the building and would have come outside And I want to point out to you that what we're witnessing since they have gone to the one chemical execution formula, that the time from when the process begins to when the person being executed is declared dead has increased. And I don't know. I will leave it to your imagination to think about what's going on in that chamber. It seems to me that it could be argued that prolonging the process is just a variation on the theme of torture. But I'll let you mull over that and come to your own conclusions over that. But I will point out that we are now 15 minutes past the time we would normally have heard from Gloria that the execution has been completed and the witnesses are crossing the road. I didn't mean to interfere your discussion, but I just wanted to point that out to the audience, because in these kind of things, the passage of time is an element of what we're talking about.
I tell you what, Ray, you talked earlier and asked the question where a lot of things done on the appeal. This is an unusual case in this sense. We've gone through a whole bunch of stuff where Larry's talked about how people got a lot of due process. In this case, the crime was so bad and so horrible that our appellate courts pretty well slam dunk everything. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. Normally, when you have a direct appeal, if there's something significant, they will publish that opinion. There were no published opinions anywhere. The Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed it on direct appeal, no published opinion. Just wham, bam. The writ that was filed in state court, they simply said, we accept the trial judge's findings of fact and slam dunk that. Gets into federal court, goes into district court. They give him a chance to have a hearing on some of his issues. He waived the hearing. And they summarily denied him his writ and denied him the right to a certificate of appealability. That was non-published. Goes to the Fifth Circuit. They denied a certificate of appealability, and that was non-published. They didn't waste a lot of paper on this case. Everything is pretty short and to the point. And the appellate courts pretty well have hammered this case out pretty quickly. There's not a lot
and
of stuff.
This Supreme Court appeal didn't take a lot of time. Well, we spent a lot of time worrying about that.
The issues in the Supreme Court case were just, at best, something just to pray. Be like hoping the next pope would be a Baptist. There were absolutely no hope at all. Because they had what we call a Batson issue, claiming there was racial prejudice in the jury selection. And they also had an issue claiming that the numbers on being retarded were not accurate. Those were all pretty hopeless arguments.
They did, as you poignantly said in another case, they did not kill a lot of trees.
Didn't kill a, I doubt they killed a limb in this one. I'm not sure a leaf got rustled in this one.
Well, what does the lawyer do? Well, you could walk into the courthouse when you're a younger feller and somebody throw you this case and say, this is your case.
What you would normally do in a case that's not the death penalty, oftentimes, if you know the issue is going to be punishment. In this case, Larry was absolutely right. It's either life or death. That was the issue in this case. Oftentimes, you'll enter a plea of guilty to give some means of credibility to your client, to the jury.
And maybe cut down some of the evidence.
And cut down some of the evidence. Because what you can do, by entering a plea of guilty, whenever the state calls a witness to test about the gory facts, you can take them on cross and say, look, did you realize you didn't have to come back through and relive this experience? Because I entered a plea of guilty. And the reason I did is to prevent you from having to relive that horrible experience you've gone through. And that's what you do when you enter pleas of guilty. But every lawyer in the world is scared to death in a death penalty case to enter a plea of guilty to a jury, because they're going to claim you're ineffective anyway. And the truth of the matter is that I don't know what studies have been, but in virtually every case you ever read, about the majority of them, all of them claim the lawyer's ineffective. That's a basic argument you always make. And like the professor said, the difficult thing is I don't care if the guy had been drunk every day. What in the world could you do with this set of facts?
Joe Cannon couldn't have done a worse job.
Well, unless a wig got in the way. But what you do in a case like that, and I'm very sympathetic with the lawyers. As a matter of fact, what he did, and I think this is the only tactic you can take, when there was one witness, I don't recall if it was a guy who walked in on the murders.
It was a survivor.
It was a survivor. When the survivor was testifying, the survivor was crying. And when they said, pass the witness, all the defense lawyers said, I want you to know that I'm very sorry. Because what can you say in a situation like that? So what you've got to do in a case like that, and I have been there, and everybody who's tried these cases have been there, when your case is that hopeless on guilt or innocence, what you want to do is do your best to build up some believability with the jury. Do your best to try to explain how this guy got in that situation. And what you normally want to do, if it's humanly possible, and they didn't do it in this case, and perhaps for obvious reasons, one of the things you always do to get sympathy is put your client on the stand, let him show some emotion, and show that he's sorry for it. And in a case like this, where this guy has this record, he may not have performed very well.
Yeah, well, he was apparently, to some degree, looking for the opportunity to confess to the media. That sounds ominous for putting him on the stand.
Well, plus he had that problem. He was fixing to kill his girlfriend. He was playing that one.
He wasn't quite through yet.
He wasn't finished up yet.
He was also thrown out. Apparently, they put him in a program for aggressive.
Now, Larry said that he was
mentally ill,
out.
And he was thrown out of that program.
Yeah, the prison system.
Right.
Yeah. That's difficult. I mean, and trust me, I've lived in prison, and I'm going to be talking to a young man next week about going to prison and the things to watch out for. But you're trapped. I mean, you literally have no escape from your cellie overnight. Thanks to the efficiency of Elizabeth Stein, our producer, received a note that there is no movement in Huntsville. There are no pending appeals or pending clemency that has any chance of delaying this process. It is now 6:41. That is more than 20 minutes after the normal time from the beginning of the process to the execution. This process has been extended twice since we have gone to a single drug formula for execution. That causes me a great deal of consternation. I don't know whether you can tell it in my voice, but the amount of time it is taking to execute someone has increased by 100% from the three drug formula to the one drug formula. And I don't know what the witnesses in that execution chamber are watching transpire. But I do want to point out to you listening to this show that the rules have changed, the chemistry has changed, and that happened relatively smoothly. The last one was we were at 6:35 when the execution was over. Now we are at 6:42. I have no idea what's going on there, but I have grave concern. The Dallas County and the state of Texas spent about the same amount of money on this case as they would a normal case. It's just that the judges didn't print anything.
Yeah, well, let me explain. Some of that expense is the only thing the state of Texas bears. Usually when they have a death penalty case, they have two lawyers appointed. And sometimes those lawyers' fees will run $30,000, $40,000. That's at the trial level. Then they're appointed a lawyer on direct appeal. And they have to pay for the transcript to be prepared, all the court notes. And that's a pretty considerable piece, several thousand dollars for that. And then the appellate lawyer will get $10,000 to $15,000. So at that point, you're talking about $40,000 or $50,000 just to get at that point. And then we have a system now where we're appointing lawyers on post-conviction writs. And that varies. The Court of Criminal Appeals has got a program doing that, and you might as well add another $10,000 or $15,000 for that. But when you go into federal court, that's all done by volunteer people. There's no state funds done for that. The only state funds expended are when the attorney general represents a state and they have to use their personnel and their paperwork to fight against the death penalty. And that's how it pretty well runs in Texas. And a death penalty case, if you total up all the expenses in Texas, will run $100,000 to $150,000 easily. But you've got to realize that whether the DA that handled the case was prosecuting this case, he's still going to be paid anyway. So you have to kind of kick that out. And as far as extra expenses, you're talking about $100,000 to $150,000. And truthfully, with this conduct, because we talked about this earlier, a lot of people that are on death row have adjusted well to prison life. When they get in a structured environment, they do well. And in this particular case, what's unique about it, he didn't do well in the free world and doesn't do well in prison. And if the question you ask a jury, would he be a danger in the future, there's not any jury in the state of Texas that say he wouldn't be a danger in the future. I don't care what county it's in. And I think in a case like this, virtually any county, perhaps with the exception of Walter, who just refused to do it, would seek the death penalty in this case.
Well, the way it works, actually, is the jury is asked three questions. And they can thumbs up or thumbs down on each of those questions. What are those questions, and how do they apply to this case? Anybody?
There, you talked about it earlier. Is it a deliberate act?
Right.
Dangerous to mitigation?
Exactly.
That's the three questions. First one is, was it a deliberate act? Well, when you say you intentionally kill somebody, that's a deliberate act. So when you say guilty, that answers.
Plenty of evidence of getting cars and guns and making all that written.
And the next question they ask the jury, will he be likely to be a danger in the future? Well,
he's been a danger in the past. And
he's a danger where he's gone. Yeah. And plus, he's planning to kill.
Plus, you had like 7 or 8 prison guards, I think, showed
15.
Up. 15. All right. There was a chorus.
Call chorus. And then the mitigating factors, after all that evidence comes in, you have what we call mitigating factors. And meaning, does a person, because he had a deprived childhood or something horrible happening to him, is he somebody who's not death-worthy, is the word they use. It's called a Penry issue. We nicknamed it that. And the mitigating factors in this were the fact he came from a horrible childhood. One, we saw his parents, one shoot the other parent. And he lived in a bad neighborhood. And those are basically the mitigating factors. And what they will say on those mitigating factors is whether or not somebody shouldn't receive the death penalty because of their tragic childhood.
On that issue of cost of having a death penalty prosecution, though, Jim, you can't overlook what it costs the state for the prosecutors. I mean, in Harris County, we've got prosecutors who are already qualified for that.
But they're going to be paid. If they're trying to death penalty.
Yeah, they're drawing the salary anyway.
But if we didn't have any death penalty cases, and it's seen more clearly on a small...
They've never hired extra lawyers to get death penalty cases.
In the smaller counties, though. Okay, say like some of the smaller counties where they might hire Kelly Siegel or somebody like that to come and handle the death penalty case. It does cost the state money to even from the prosecution side. If Harris County stopped doing death penalty cases, for instance, the cost for the prosecutor's office would also go down. So I'm saying you can pretty much double the cost for the death penalty.
Larry, I hate to interrupt you, but we have a report from Huntsville.
Oh, great.
Okay. Yes, Gloria, you're on the air.
The media has come out, and the witnesses, they just opened the door. I imagine the witnesses are now coming out.
Gloria, before you continue, my clock says...
We have a large group of people out here protesting, including two women that are not from France, but they're from Sweden.
Okay, Gloria, I want your comment about the fact that it is now 6:48.
It's 6:48, and I'm watching his family and Penn fans walk out
okay,
of the wall.
Okay, this execution has... cost more time. What went on in that death chamber? Because normally, if the process under the three-drug formula happened, we had a report before 6:30.
Right.
This is a 100% increase of time for the execution process. What comes to my mind is images of a slow, torturous death.
Well, what I've been told, Ray, and I don't do heavy drugs, so I don't know, but it's like ODing on heroin or something, where you just, it takes a while, but eventually you die, and perhaps it isn't painful. I don't know. I don't know that much about drugs. But yeah, it has taken twice as long as executions took when they used three drugs. I'm hoping that this is actually less painful.
Well, I hope so, too, but you know how distrustful I am with state processes.
Well, and it's very painful for the friends who are standing out here agonizing over what in the world is going on in the death chamber. So I don't know. I mean, we would have to talk to somebody that's witnessed.
Well, I suppose Grazik's report tomorrow will tell us something about what happened in the chamber. Because I don't think that Grazik could overlook the extended time.
Well, the first one that took 40 minutes, it seems like he didn't say much. I remember his report being not informative.
Yeah.
I was curious after waiting 40 minutes and wondering, what in the hell is going on?
Well, I think that if his report does not include this, I think that I need to give a call and do an interview with Grazik because I need to know what's going on in that room.
And this is just the third one with the single drug.
Right.
But regardless of what happened in the execution chamber tonight, another person is dead, number 485 for Texas, and 246 for Rick Perry. His parents are deceased, the man that was murdered tonight. His brother has been the responsible family member, but I've been told by one of his pen pals' friends that he's going to be buried in the morning, which leads me to believe that the family has no money and he's going to be buried out here.
Out here in Joe Bird.
In Joe Bird Cemetery here in Huntsville. Because otherwise I don't know why it would happen so quickly. The woman from San Antonio whose friend witnessed and her friend has written him for 8 years, they're getting ready to go to the church to view the body. And then she said, and he'll be buried in the morning. She didn't know where, but I assume it's going to be here.
Yeah. Tell us about the ladies from Sweden. We're running out of time, and didn't want to cut you off there, but I had those questions of my own.
Yeah. Well, okay, and this is Anna, and she's from Sweden. Do you visit Obi or your friend?
Ishan.
Anyway, they both just left death row. They've been visiting. So this is Anna. I'm going to put her on. Okay?
Yes. Anna? Anna? Anna?
Hello.
You're on the air. We're broadcasting from KPFT in Houston. So you've come all the way from Sweden to visit someone on death row. Who is that, your friend?
Yes. His name is Kishan, and it was his first time. It was very, I can't say fun, but it was very interesting. You know, it's horrible.
And now that you're in to visit your friend who himself is on the row and may someday face a date, you go to downtown Huntsville and this horrible thing happens.
Yes.
Will you do me a favor?
Yes.
When you get back to your home country,
yes,
would you tell people about what is going on here so that they will understand that we need their help to end it?
I'm doing that all the time. And, you know, even though we abolished the death penalty in 1921, there are many people that want to, you know, have it again. And most people don't care. They think I'm crazy. Why do you do this? Blah, blah, blah. It's very annoying.
Thank you very much. Give my regards to the fellow vigilants there. And
yes,
I've got to move the program off the air. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And that was the report from Huntsville. I am still concerned about that delay. My name is Ray Hill, and we do this show only on the occasion where Texas kills people. In order to do this show, I want to express my sincere appreciation to Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, and Larry Douglas for bringing their professional expertise in here on a volunteer basis. On tonight's show, I want to thank Professor Kenneth Williams with South Texas College of Law in downtown Houston, a wonderful place. That website, if you want to learn more about the school, is www.stcl.edu. Of course, Glory Ruback is our reliable picket line supervisor from Huntsville, and she is with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and their website is simply abolitionmovement.org. Jennifer Simmons, who reported from the demonstration here in Houston, and by the way, there are demonstrations in several cities around the state when this happens, but Jennifer's information can be gleaned at www.tcadp.com. The next scheduled execution is a friend of mine. It's going to be a little different show. Cleve Sarge Foster is scheduled to be executed next Tuesday. The interview on that show, the interview we did with Professor Kenneth Williams tonight, that interview will be with Sarge himself. I went to death row, took an interview with him because he wanted to be the last word in his execution watch show. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein for doing all the hard work to make this happen, and you can email Elizabeth at eliza.tex.usa@gmail.com. eliza.tex.usa@gmail.com. Our engineer tonight has been Craig Brooks, who's broken in tonight. I appreciate Bob giving him a hand up in the beginning, but he has done well. Our music is, of course, by Victoria Panetti, whose brother is on death row, and she can be found at She Monster International, /myspace.com/She Monster. My name is Ray Hill. Stay tuned to KPFT for other interesting programs. We will have a prison show tomorrow night at 9 p.m. And that 33-year-old tradition continues with new host. And so I want to thank you very much for listening to Execution Watch. I hope next show is canceled. I don't enjoy covering the execution of friends of mine. We have other programmers coming into the studio, and it's going to be time to process out. If you have any concerns or questions about the show, you can always email me. That's hillray@sbcglobal.net. Hillray, H-I-L-L-R-A-Y, @sbcglobal.net. This has been Execution Watch on KPFT, Houston.